Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood. Heresy, apostasy even. Four guests today in three segments. David Adler and Matt Kierkegaard, the Progressive International, will report on the elections in Honduras. El Fadil Ibrahim will offer another view of the war in Sudan. And Eric Blanc will talk about the relevance of Milwaukee's sewer socialism to politics today. Honduras held elections last Sunday. There were three major candidates, Rixey Moncada of the governing Libre Party, Salvador Nasralla, conventionally described as center-right, and Nasri Esfura from the further right. Esfura was the laggard until days before the election, when he was endorsed by Donald Trump in his typically crude and incomprehensible fashion. Almost simultaneously, Trump pardoned the former president Juan Orlando Hernandez from Esfura's party, who was convicted of shipping 400 tons of cocaine into the U.S. and about to begin a long prison sentence. In Trump world, Venezuelans of unknown identity and intent in small boats deserve death from the air, but right-wing major traffickers deserve freedom. Suddenly, Esfura went from a dark horse to credible candidate. As I'm preparing this show, the vote count is still incomplete, but Esfura and Nasralla were tied around 40% apiece, with the left candidate far behind. To review what's been going on, we're joined by the Behind the News roving election watch team, David Adler and Matt Kierkegaard of the Progressive International. They've done similar reports in this show about Peru and Chile, and also Honduras 4 years ago. David Adler and Matt Kierkegaard. Let's review the, my sports metaphors are terrible, so let's just talk about the three candidates.
The lineup.
Yeah, the lineup. There were three major candidates. Who were they, and what parties and ideologies do they represent?
The governing party is the party Libre of Liberty and Democratic Refoundation, which refers to their founding ambition to bring new independence, new constitutional order after 12 years of dictatorship. Many of your listeners will remember the democratic elections in 2007, which brought to power President Mel Zelaya, a former ranchero, a former kind of liberal figure who, in the course of his government, tended to lean more and more towards the sovereigntist Latin Americanist pole that was at that time being led by Hugo Chavez and the ALBA bloc that was very menacing to the Obama administration, for example, who saw that as a threat to their own doctrine of kind of hemispheric dominance at that time. And that led to, on the U.S., a kind of passive and support for a military coup in 2009 that saw Mel Zelaya and his family forced to flee the country, and the military leading a coup that would eventually put the National Party in charge. So I'm condensing a huge amount of history here. Many things happened in the course of those 12 years, selling off the country to crypto colonialists like Peter Thiel, introducing horrendous forms of deregulation and plundering of the country, of course, the reinsertion of U.S. kind of military and economic interest into the country. And then in 2021, Mel Zelaya's wife, who at that time had become a leading figure in the force to recover the country's democracy and to fight back against what was then very kind of uncontroversially accused of being a narco-dictatorship, they won these elections with a big, broad front coalition to face off against the National Party. And they are the ones who've been governing for the past 4 years, not without problems of divided legislature, not without problems of confronting foreign interest and such, but also with huge successes. You know, in the past year alone, Honduras has led the region in a 4% reduction of poverty, for example, alongside massive social programs and infrastructure development of housing, education, and the like. So that was the program, the record, or rather, on which they were running. And I'll leave to Matt to explain kind of the profile of the other two candidates against which Xiomara Castro's party, represented in this election by the former finance minister, former defense minister, Rixey Moncada, a very credentialed, very serious candidate. She was facing off against two men in this election, and I'll let Matt give a bit of background about who they were.
One is Salvador Nasralla from the Liberal Party, and the other is Tito Esfura from the National Party. And let's start with Nasralla. The Liberal Party, and Nasralla in particular, it's a sort of a catch-all party. Traditionally, it's been on the center or the center-left of Honduran politics, and in fact, Salvador Nasralla was the candidate of the joint center and left wing in 2017. He was the vice president elected with Xiomara Castro in 2021, but then left the administration and became one of its greatest critics and is viewed really as sort of a candidate that is up for sale, frankly. His campaign has been focused on, it was really a campaign oriented towards social media and towards the United States. In some of the rallies, his supporters would march with U.S. flags. He attended the U.S. congressional hearings on the elections last week and ultimately was rejected by Trump. Trump called him almost a communist.
Which is completely fanciful, right?
Completely fanciful. He belongs on the center-right, if not just the right outright, as a candidate. And, of course, Trump then gave his endorsement to Tito Asfura from the National Party. And as David said, the National Party was in charge and in control after the coup in 2009 all the way through to 2021. A right-wing party, a machine party, a party with deep capacities to mobilize voters, even in rural areas, with narco-machine links. Those two candidates are now about neck and neck in the vote count, and we'll see how it all turns out.
Two questions here. One, if the record of the Liberty Party was pretty impressive, why did they do so badly?
Well, a couple things are important to explaining that vote count. I think there's a regional story that is important to tell alongside the national story in Honduras. The first is that, you know, across the region, we're seeing that there have been left-wing or progressive victories in countries as disparate as Chile and Brazil and Colombia and Mexico, a kind of second pink tide, as many people would prefer to see it. But the fact is that those victories have almost always come through a pact between left-wing forces who've taken the vanguard, oftentimes through a series of social mobilizations, oftentimes violent mobilizations, as we saw in the so-called estallidos social that took over the streets of Santiago, Chile, took over the streets of Bogota, Colombia, took over the streets of Tegucigalpa, Honduras. You see the left reclaim some protagonism, but fundamentally rely in an arithmetic sense on a pact with liberal parties. And what happens often is when that pact phrase and as in the case of Honduras, liberals go their own way and face off against the left. The numbers are not there to compose the kinds of majorities that you would need to defeat the right on its own, especially in the context of a country like Honduras, which, in contrast to others, doesn't have a two-round runoff process. It's just a straight shot. You get one go, and whoever wins in that first round, first past the post style, is going to win it all. So there's not even room for a second-rounded kind of recomposition of that left-liberal pact that has carried the country. The second is more specific to Honduras. Honduras is just a very complex, very poor, very difficult country in which to mount a programmatic and developmentalist politics, not just because it's heavily astroturfed with U.S. propaganda and mediatic problems, not just because of enduring structural dependencies, for example, the headquarters of the U.S. Southern Command being in the Honduran capital and the outsized role, the hypertrophy of U.S. Military and diplomatic influence on Honduran politics, also because of its huge migrant populations feeling certain deep structural dependencies to the United States, feeling very menaced by the attack that Trump has led on Honduran migrants to the United States. These things make it complicated to advance an anti-colonial, anti-imperial, you might want to call it, left-wing program, and to be able to communicate that across a country, like I said, as complex and developmentally impeded as Honduras. Maybe you have some more thoughts about kind of what those challenges are. But there's also the, you know, to be a bit self-critical here, obviously Matt and I come from a position of institutional and personal sympathies with Libre and its project. We're getting outgunned and outmaneuvered across the continent in terms of the TikTokification of politics, the ways in which the right has become much more agile, much more competent in using social media platforms, as vacuous as the messaging may be. That's where a lot of young people are signing on or switching on or watching these videos scroll past on their screens. And we are just less equipped with our flag-waving, street-filling, you know, 20th century tactics to compete on a electoral terrain that has changed so much in such a short amount of time.
Now, Asfura, who got the Trump endorsement, wasn't doing so well until that endorsement came through. Why did Trump endorse him? What do you think?
Who knows?
That's always the case with Trump, right?
That's right. There's some theories. I mean, one possibility may be that if you have the possibility of endorsing someone fully in your camp or someone whose loyalty may be a suspect who formerly served in the government as vice president, why not go for the whole hog? That's a possibility. There's also been some speculation that some of the lobbying firms connected to the National Party were campaign donors to Marco Rubio in the past, for example. It's hard to say. It's really hard to say. You know, the United States has a deep relationship with the National Party in particular. It's probably a mix of all of these factors.
And what about the libertarian angle? Like, the party has been running these libertarian experiments, charter cities, heavy crypto stuff. Did that have any effect? I mean, the Thiel and Sachs are quite close to that tendency in Honduras. Did that count at all?
Well, just a little bit of background, just if I can summarize in 30 seconds. So under the in the course of that so-called narco-dictatorship that ran from 2009 to 2021, you saw the passage of legislation through a completely corrupt backdoor process that saw the then-president basically evict members of the Supreme Court to force through this legislation on the CEDES, the Zones of Employment and Economic Development, which essentially sold sovereign Honduran territory to these foreign corporations, in this case, California crypto corporations, who wanted to make these free-floating libertarian paradise entities on the Mosquito Coast, on the island of Roatán in particular, where they began to build this thing called Prospera. When Libre came back to power in the free elections of 2021, when democracy was restored to Honduras, Congress voted unanimously to close the CEDES and to reclaim Honduran national territory. It was deemed unconstitutional, which it was then as well. And as a result, were taken to the cleaners with secret arbitration courts, as you know, in Washington, D.C., to try to sort of squeeze $11 billion, two-thirds of their annual budget, out of the Honduran government as compensation for the so-called expropriation, which hadn't even happened, of the Prospera territory. So thus began a kind of campaign of defamation against the government of Xiomara Castro as being somehow expropriationist and communist and all these kinds of things, but also whispering in the ears of the MAGA kind of clan. There was some uptake by Democrats. You had, you know, the U.S. trade rep at that time, Kathy Tai, speak out against the investment climate in Honduras and the dangers of this. It wasn't just a Republican thing, but it is true that that Prospera made a pretty good bet through their former funder, Peter Thiel, on trying to getting in bed with the new Republican Party. There's something we don't know, really, which is related to, I'm sure we'll get to this, Doug, the most scandalous aspect of this whole moment in Honduran politics, which was obviously Donald Trump's exoneration of narco-dictator Juan Orlando Hernandez, of the former president of the National Party. What's not clear and what remains to be investigated by us or others is who exactly was whispering in Trump's ear, who exactly was convincing him that Tito was his guy, on what basis, and in whose interests. We know for sure that one of Prospera's, Prospera being that crypto colonial project on the island of Roatán, we know that one of their lobbyists came before Congress just 2 weeks ago, before the election, to make the case that democracy was somehow under threat because of the government of Xiomara Castro, a very ironic, very Karl Rove, turn your strength into your weakness kind of moment. And we know that Joaquin Castro, for example, on the committee, try to push back on the credibility or the conflicts of interest therein. But we just don't yet know. These are the kinds of things that in Trump world oftentimes come out through people speaking too openly and frankly at Mar-a-Lago. So maybe we will get a fuller account of the process that led to this series of very drastic moves, geopolitical moves that had such a profound influence on the trajectory of Honduran democracy. But it's not totally clear yet. One would need to process trace a bit more, like the precise influence that Thiel and Prospera and their lobbyists had in Honduras. One, the reason why I'm hesitant to overstate it is because Honduras is a colony, well, I won't overstate it, is a, as Mel Zelaya would say, a democracia tutelada. It's a tutelage democracy still. I mean, when you fly to Honduras, to Palmarola, you fly into a U.S. military base. If you go to Tegucigalpa, it's swarming with U.S. military service people. So it's not as if it's only Prospera, it's only the Thiel crypto guys who are trying to use Honduras as a site of economic extraction or forward military deployment. There's a wide range of interests that bring the attention of the White House and others to the electoral arena in Central America in general.
Now, why do you think Trump pardoned Hernandez, and what effect did that have in Honduras?
Before the election, I would have said that it was a major blunder because it put Ho, as he's known, J-O-H, or his initials, and in Spanish you would pronounce that Ho, it put him back in the spotlight, and it put the years of the narco dictatorship against which Xiomara Castro was swept into office in 2021 back into the spotlight. You know, at that point in 2021, during her electoral victory, you know, she was playing a version of New York, New York as one of her campaign songs, alluding to the fact that Juan Orlando Hernandez was going to be arrested and extradited to New York on these drug trafficking charges that he was ultimately convicted of. I think that the assessment of the Trump administration was such that ultimately it was a demonstration of power by the United States in an election where the U.S. had put its hand so firmly on the scales in a number of ways that we're seeing across the region, from, you know, Trump's blackmail of Argentine voters last month to the possible impending war in Venezuela. This was just another hand on the scales to demonstrate that the United States has control of the situation, and to show that even a completely disgraced, narco-trafficking, unpopular president will be granted full clemency, and that you know, the U.S. interests reign supreme above all else. And that signal was, I think, widely understood in the elections. Several of the candidates, Nasrallah in particular, you know, alluded to the U.S. Armada off the coast of Venezuela and said, you know, look, if the U.S. thinks there's fraud in Honduras, it's possible that Armada just might come over here and change things militarily. The shadow of the United States was completely omnipresent, as were the tweets of Donald Trump and the statements. And I think, as I said, this was just the demonstration of United States power and that they can do whatever they want.
Trump also threatened tariffs and cutting off aid, too. So he was really pulling out all the stops. And then, of course, his definition of electoral fraud is rather flexible. So his analysis of the honesty of this election will be very interesting to follow if his candidate doesn't win.
With Honduras, we need to take a more regional perspective. It's now become more de mode to speak about the Monroe Doctrine, its renovation, its reassertion. And I think that Honduras is a notch in the belt now. I mean, we're watching unprecedented after unprecedented move by the Trump administration, at least in the 21st century. A $40 billion bailout, 20 plus 20 for Argentina, that saved Milei's ass and guaranteed him this really sweeping victory in legislative elections in Argentina. Honduras is the next one after that. We're seeing the U.S. tip the scales. Well, some of its strongest soldiers are still deployed out there to speak the language of free and fair elections, while, you know, we're the ones menacing them across the hemisphere. We have to see this as part of a broader plan that is playing out across what they perceive to be a chessboard of, or not to mix metaphors, but across their backyard. And I think that's how they see it. You know, one can only hope that the brazenness and the brutality of such an intervention and the hypocrisy of it. I mean, you've got a guy, obviously, as I was saying, who's leading a campaign against narco terror in the case of, you know, Venezuela, who's just pardoned the most like widely recognized narco terrorist of the region of the National Party and brought his party back to power. So one would hope that the brazenness of that gesture can spark to life a movement to, you know, resist the Monroe Doctrine, to reconstruct a kind of anti-colonial bloc across the continent or something. But I wouldn't want to get ahead of myself in predicting such a thing.
Those are David Adler and Matt Kierkegaard of the Progressive International. And now a brief follow-up to a segment I did a couple of weeks ago with Musab Baba about the civil war in Sudan, a horrific and bloody thing that has killed hundreds of thousands and displaced millions. While there are plenty of internal fissures in the country, the conflict has been prolonged and worsened by outside actors, notably Egypt, which supports one of the two principal antagonists, the Sudanese armed forces, and the UAE, which supports the other, the Rapid Support Forces, a paramilitary group that was once on the government side but is now fighting against it. Here with more is Elfadil Ibrahim, who's written about the war for responsible statecraft, the online magazine of the Quincy Institute, among other outlets. This interview was recorded a few weeks ago, so some of the time references are off. Elfadil Ibrahim. Do these forces have any popular support, or are they just pretty much fighting for their own and their foreign backers?
That's a good question and kind of complicated. So, you know, we have to kind of go back and look at, before the war, what kind of popular support these forces have. And they didn't have much, because the Sudanese street was essentially allied and was united in the fact that Sudan's politics shouldn't be militarized. And, you know, the popular calls were for a civilian transition and for the military, you know, all the security sector to basically leave the political arena. After the war, that dynamic changed because the way that now many Sudanese people see this war as a foreign invasion, because the RSF has many mercenaries that it's gathered from throughout the region, and many have voluntarily become recruits or have voluntarily joined the military as part of a massive conscription campaign. because they see that war, and they see this war as like a war of dignity or an invasion of sorts. The RSF only has popular support among its base, its tribal base, so the leadership of the RSF is homogenous in terms of its ethnic makeup for the most part, Arab Darfuris, belonging to the Rezegat clan, the Rezegat tribe. So you'll find in the RSF that many of the Arabs throughout Darfur have, you know, either through force or on their own volition, joined the RSF because they see this as essentially like a force that represents them.
I'm curious about that name. Who are they supporting rapidly?
Yeah, so that's a good question. And, I mean, essentially the RSF, the Rapid Support Forces, the whole idea of its creation was that it was going to be supporting the Sudanese armed forces. So it's an auxiliary force. And part of the reasons for the war was the military said that, you know, it's time for you to join the SAF, for you to merge your forces. And that was not what the leadership of the RSF had in mind, because they had already amassed immense fortunes from gold smuggling and from other activities.
Yeah, it's not many states that would tolerate paramilitary forces as rivals for its own army.
Absolutely.
The gold smuggling is an important part of this story, right? It's a major supplier of gold now, right, Sudan? And who's making the money off that?
Sudan is one of the biggest gold producers in Africa, and it has been for the last few years. Essentially, what you have is gold operations throughout the country, mainly in the west, in the territory that the RSF controls, and also in northern Sudan, which is territory controlled by the SAF. So both the SAF and the RSF are economic machines in their own right. They are very heavily involved in the gold trade. Funnily enough, both of them have the same customer base. A lot of the gold from both ends up in the United Arab Emirates. This is the trade that both of them are involved in, and many regular citizens are too. It's artisanal, so it's a lot of individual gold miners going to these regions, mining the gold, and usually selling it to companies connected to one of those entities.
This war has lots of foreign actors involved, and the U.S. plays only a secondary role. So who's who, and what are their various aims in supporting these factions?
This is really what's been in the news lately, because it's becoming apparent to many people observing this conflict that a lot of countries are involved. The main countries are those in the region. So Egypt is probably the SAF's biggest supporter. Diplomatically especially, Egypt has been very open about the fact that it backs the Sudanese armed forces and it sees it as a national force. And of course, it doesn't take too kindly to a paramilitary force that wants to seize power. You've got also Saudi Arabia, which has also increasingly becoming vocal about its support for the SAF and also for its disapproval of the UAE's backing of the RSF. The SAF also has allies like Iran, Turkey, Russia, and oddly, even Ukraine. Ukraine has supplied special forces, and they were seen on the ground.
Yeah, the UAE, they're active in lots of fronts. What is their game? What are they trying to accomplish with all this international maneuvering?
The UAE has held ambitions for a long time to become a major power broker in the region, especially like the Red Sea region, the Sahel, North Africa. And we saw this previously in neighboring countries like Libya, where it backed the Libyan National Army. And that army is now an ally of the RSF, helping to reroute soldiers and military equipment to the RSF, especially since Libya connects with Sudan and Darfur. The UAE essentially has numerous interests in Sudan and in backing the RSF, besides the gold trade, which most of that gold ends up in the UAE. It also has ideological alignment with the RSF. The RSF is vocally anti-Islamist. One of the key components of the SAF coalition is the Islamist connected to the old regime of Omar al-Bashir. So this is really just part of the UAE's power projection playbook. It's been used throughout the last decade or so, and it's finding its implementation now in Sudan.
I'm wondering where Trump is. I mean, this guy, you know, claims to have solved 8 wars, so why not make it 9? Has he been involved at all?
You know, Trump seems to be missing in action totally. Besides a few statements made over the last year or so, there doesn't seem to be any presidential activity or any kind of desire to get involved directly. And this is probably related to the fact that Trump's ties to the president of the UAE, Mohammed bin Zayed, are very strong. We saw Trump visit Abu Dhabi and visit the UAE president and say some great things. He called him, quote-unquote, a magnificent man. The UAE has, you know, pledged a ton of money in the U.S. economy, over $1 trillion, and has signed billions of dollars of deals in AI and in many areas. So it's very clear why President Trump has not really been more vocal on this.
Would coming to some sort of peace agreement require the U.S. to be involved, or could it happen without American involvement?
It's very difficult to see this happening, see any kind of peace process happening without the U.S. being involved. And the main reason is the fact that a lot of the players involved in Sudan are U.S. allies. So if anyone's positioned to stabilize the situation in Sudan, it's the U.S. I don't see it happening any other way.
So meanwhile, the people of Sudan are suffering displacement, bombing, starvation, disease, while all these other outsiders are just playing their own games.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And I mean, you know, it's very easy to look at this conflict and just say that, you know, it's outside powers fueling the fight. But I mean, there's also internal dynamics that are pushing both sides to fight one another. A lot of it is part and parcel of the flaws that have led to the collapse of Sudan, the existence of more than one army, those armies having deep involvement in the economy. So even if you remove foreign involvement, sure, it will probably help reduce civilian suffering, reduce the harm. But you have to bridge the gap also between the SAF and the RSF.
That was the writer and political analyst Elfadil Ibrahim. Since we recorded the interview, Mohammed bin Salman, the Saudi leader better known as MBS, tried to persuade Donald Trump to get the UAE to pull back. We'll see if anything comes of this. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News, back after a musical break.
My future is a maze. My thoughts a total haze. My life is a mess. I want to feel less. My future is a maze. My thoughts a total haze. My life is a mess. I want to feel less. My future is a maze. My thoughts a total haze. My life is a mess. I want to feel less, to feel less, to feel less.
There was some of Feel Less by Key 4050, remixed by Amelie Lenz. Next, sewer socialism. With two socialists weeks away from taking office as big city mayors, Zoran Mamdani in New York and Katie Wilson in Seattle, it's worth looking at the story of the greatest episode of municipal socialism in U.S. history, Milwaukee from 1910 to 1960. Eric Blanc, the labor journalist and scholar, has an excellent article on the topic on his Substack at laborpolitics.com. Eric Blanc. Sewer socialism. It doesn't get the blood moving like Workers of the World Unite, you have nothing to lose but your chains, but it does have its charm. So what does it mean exactly, and where did it come from?
It's funny, it's a pejorative term. It's not something that they used at the time. It was used by opponents or critics to suggest that these Milwaukee socialists weren't, in fact, true socialists, that really what they were trying to do is just improve public services, like the sewer system. The thrust of my research found, and what I try to argue, is that, no, actually, they were real socialists. Their goal was overthrowing capitalism, but they saw the importance of governing locally and delivering real wins to working people as a necessary precondition for giving workers the confidence and raised ambitions to get something more.
People have this general sense that nothing works, and actually addressing that issue is of political importance, although people like us with grand ideas about remaking the world don't always see the appeal of that.
To go back to the sewer question, it sounds almost like very modest, oh, you know, the sewers. But if you were a working class person in Milwaukee in the early 1900s, there was a decent chance your kids would be threatened by, could die from typhoid, right? So you have to put yourself in the moment at the time. These were burning issues for people. And it wasn't just public health, but it was basic cost of living issues. And these are the bread and butter issues that they fought around. And they understood something fundamental, which I think a lot of leftists don't, which is that the number one obstacle we're up against is this sense of resignation, the sense that working people feel just powerless, that politics is something that others do, it's not something they do. And so what the sewer socialists learned through experience was that, no, actually, everything we have to do is, both whether it's in the state or outside the state, is give working people a sense of power and confidence and raised ambitions, and it's going to be that process that gets us towards socialism.
Yeah, I was struck when you wrote that about people feeling that sense of resignation 100-plus years ago, because it seems very contemporary as well.
Yeah, I think it did really resonate with me. And it's funny because they stressed the importance of hope in the same way that Zoran did, you know, in his victory speech. It was almost word for word. It sounded like it could have been from a sewer socialist, explaining that really what the project is in New York City isn't just on the specific agenda points, although obviously that's the centerpiece, but it's ultimately to give people a sense that, A, the public sector can work, and B, their lives can be better, and C, that they have an active role to play in that, right? I think that's what Zoran said, is politics isn't something that's just done to us, it's something we do. And so that's essentially sewer socialism.
Yeah, it's funny, sewers, that's very relevant to our personal situation here because, you know, in the heavier rainstorms we've been getting with climate change, the sewers can't handle it. They back up in our basement floods. So we really need some serious work in the sewers to address this. And I don't even know that anybody's talking about that or thinking about it, but sewer socialism for the 21st century.
Yeah, I like that. And it goes to the question of, what does it mean to be a socialist in charge of a city? Because obviously you can't overthrow capitalism within one urban area. And so that's, you know, that's part of the issue. It's not that they didn't want to overthrow capitalism, but they ran City Hall and that wasn't, you know, within their power to do. But there's a lot of things you can do if you take seriously the idea of government as serving the people and not just sort of a platform for your ego or your personal ambitions. And they made that clear. And that was a real break from decades of corruption and just business as usual. And they showed that the way you end corruption in city government, the way you make city government actually work, is not just by electing people with nice promises, but you need people with politics that go against big business, because that, in their mind, and I think made a strong case, was the source of corruption. It was all of these local politicians greasing the wheels for different contracts, all of that. If you have an anti-capitalist perspective, it makes you much less prone to corruption. But then B, they took seriously the question of making public services better and work. In their mind, they had to be able to show that to be the case for people to ever even dream big enough to imagine that, you know, the economy as a whole could be run by the government or by some sort of economic democracy. If you couldn't even show that in the city, they felt, I think, rightly, well, you're not going to be able to show that on a nationwide level.
Wisconsin, especially Milwaukee, was the hotbed of local socialism. Why, when, and how pervasive was this socialist agenda?
This was the most powerful the U.S. socialist movement has ever been, and it still is more powerful than even we are in New York City today. To give a sense of it, the sewer socialists ran Milwaukee for most of 50 years, from 1910 through 1960 with a few off years. And not only that, they did that before they won the leadership of the entire labor movement of Wisconsin and Milwaukee. So it wasn't just primarily an electoral project. If anything, it was primarily a labor movement project that then took a political dimension. They spent 20 years winning over unions, and it was on that union basis that then in 1910 they were able to elect a mayor. So you're talking about a mass movement that led both a massive socialist party. They had one member for every 100 people in Milwaukee. Can you think about that? As a point of comparison, in New York City, where we also have a strong socialist movement, we have about one member about every 700 workers today, or 700 people in New York City. So it was a mass movement in the state, but also outside of it. They had the unions, but they had just a very robust cultural life too. You know, the choirs and the sports leagues and the carnivals and the saloons. It was really like a working class culture in the best sense. It was almost like a way of life in a way that we haven't come anywhere close to replicating.
Yeah, as you say, this didn't happen suddenly. It was the work of decades, right?
Yeah, they started in the 1870s. They didn't win their first serious election until 1904 in city council, and then they didn't win mayorship until 1910. So that all sounds like almost inevitable in hindsight. You know, sometimes that's the way the story is told. Well, there's a lot of Germans in Milwaukee, and so of course they like socialism, and it's almost like a Milwaukee idiosyncrasy. And what that really underestimates is how much work it took to build that power outside the state and then inside the state. And then also just on the particularities, it's not actually the case that most Germans in the U.S. were pro-socialist. The people who came to the U.S. tended to be, as many immigrants were, looking for the American dream. Germans actually, if you look at the data, tended to vote against socialism on a nationwide level more than other immigrant groups. So it really did take a lot of hard work and a lot of savvy organizing and a lot of kind of reading the temperature of the masses. This is one of the things that I think electoral campaigns really discipline socialists to do, is you really have to get a sense of where a majority of people are. You can't just hope that eventually they're going to come around. You get tested every 2 years, every 4 years, to see whether what you're saying actually resonates or not, and then you have to adjust accordingly.
The role of elections is controversial on the left. There are people who scorn them, people who center their strategies on them. So it's a point of controversy, but you come down on the side that it's pretty central to having any kind of achievements.
There's just so much evidence that, particularly in a country like the United States, you know, you can leave aside maybe somewhere like China or Tsarist Russia or Germany a century ago. But in a capitalist democracy like the United States, the reality is there's no path towards building a mass socialist movement that doesn't put a central focus on running to win and passing real changes and winning real changes for working people. The unfortunate reality is you just won't get taken seriously by most workers if you're not engaging with the state in a serious way, not just sort of in a propagandistic way, like, you know, like a Green Party campaign where you just run to make a point, but running to win like Zoran did, like the sewer socialists did, and then when in power, doing all of the fights both inside the state, outside the state through movements, and compromises, frankly, that are necessary to actually deliver. And if you have that approach, you're able to build a mass movement amongst working people. And if you don't, what you do is you build small sects. And in Milwaukee, there's plenty of small socialist sects who just sort of talk about Marxism and hope the masses will eventually come around. And that's been the fate of anybody who's taken that approach in the United States. If you just rely on winning people just through the force of your ideas, there's very few people you're going to win over, because people need to see you deliver before they'll take seriously your long-term vision.
Okay, a central figure in all this is Victor Berger. I was surprised to learn he recruited Eugene Debs to socialism, which is no small achievement. Who was he? What were his politics? Where did he come from?
Yeah, Victor Berger was a German immigrant, actually, you know, from Austria, the German-speaking Austria, comes to the U.S., kind of like a downwardly mobile middle-class family, and ends up having to take a lot of working-class jobs, cleaning dishes, branding cattle, all these kind of blue-collar jobs. But he comes from a relatively educated background and finds his way into Milwaukee and sees a socialist movement at that time in Milwaukee that was very sectarian. There was something called the Socialist Labor Party. People might have heard of it, led by a guy named Daniel De Leon, which did the kind of politics I just described, or put out the big ideas of Marxism, and eventually the masses will come around. And Victor Berger saw that it wasn't working and tried to do something very different. And his basic project was trying to Americanize Marxism and socialism, and that's what he did, actually very successfully. And it's funny because he's, you know, wasn't American born, but he took really seriously the idea that the way you get to socialism is going to look very different in different countries because contexts are different, conditions are different, popular consciousness and, you know, cultural traditions, political traditions are different. So you had to have an open mind, actually, to see what would work to build real power in a place like the United States. And based on that open-minded and pragmatic approach, he won over unions, and then those unions went over communities, and they were able to eventually build this really strong electoral project. But he was the guy. He was the, we don't really have an equivalent of that today. He was like the founder and main leader. He ended up becoming the first socialist elected to Congress in 1910. He had a kind of like an AOC effect. If you remember when AOC got elected to Congress, everyone's like, oh my God, socialist in Congress. Well, this was the first time ever. Berger was the guy. And it's funny because sometimes people are dismissive of Berger now and say he was just a reformist, has sort of just, you know, sewer socialist, all this stuff. But he really was a socialist. If you go and read all of his writings, if you look at his actions, he had the goal of overthrowing capitalism. He had the goal of really confronting this regime. And he, for that, he was prosecuted. You know, he was sentenced to 20 years for opposing World War I. So I think it's part of what I'm trying to do is rescue a little bit the sewer socialists from the dismissive takes that so much of the left and so much of historians have tended to relegate them.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of people thought of them as namby-pamby reformists. They saw it their radicalism, but that's not true at all. Underlying all this pragmatism was a serious revolutionary intention.
Yeah, I mean, it's remarkable. It's not just that they started off that way, but really up through until they were kicked out of power in 1940, they were trying to push the limits as far as possible. So just to give you one example, in the 1930s, Milwaukee was run still by a socialist, a guy named Dan Hone, who was, you know, a socialist Marxist. He would sometimes, you know, give speeches to the masses in Milwaukee about the downfall of capitalism, with the rise of the socialist future. But it wasn't just speeches. They passed in 1935 a law that I've never seen anything like this in the United States, because they had a major focus, you can imagine, in the 30s, building a mass labor movement. They passed a law called the Bond Sell Ordinance, which meant that if any company was not respecting the right of their workers to unionize, the city could close that factory if there was public disturbances. And if the bosses refused to comply, they could get put in prison. This is a level of commitment to using the state to side with workers that you can understand led to a major backlash. The big business and the media were constantly scaremongering against them, and they were constantly saying, this is going to lead to the ruin of the city, blah, blah, blah. And they went for it. They did their best to push as far as the limits of public opinion and their power within Milwaukee allowed them.
I'm speaking with the labor journalist and scholar Eric Blunk. You say that all the most successful instances of mass working class politics in America have adopted some form of this kind of pragmatic radicalism, including Minnesota's Farmer Labor Party, New York Jewish Immigrant Socialism, and the Popular Front Communists of the late 1930s. Could you say a bit more about that?
There's nothing particular about Milwaukee or the sewer socialists in the sense that the type of politics that they did has been shown to be not just successful, but really, in many ways, the only form of socialist success in the United States. And similarly, I would say, if you look at something like New York City DSA, it's a very similar type project. And really, its defining features are, on the one hand, a commitment to socialist future. They were socialists. They talked about socialism. They wanted an economic democracy. They didn't hide that. But they understood that you needed to run to win. You needed to run in order to actually win elections and not just use elections as sort of a sounding board. And then in power, you needed to do your best to actually deliver. And if you have those two strategic orientations, then it also obliges a certain level of pragmatism and compromises, because if you're running to win, you might not be foregrounding the demand to socialize the means of production. You might be foregrounding more immediate demand. And if you're in power, then oftentimes you have to make deals with other parties, and it gets very messy. And so I do think that the reality is very messy to build mass politics. There's no easy formulas, but the places where it's gone furthest, where they were able to build the biggest base, and in which they were able to win off also the most numbers of people to socialism, was where they had that basic orientation. In Minnesota, amongst the Jewish socialists in New York, and then also with the late Communist Party in the late 1930s.
What was their relation to organized labor? You mentioned a bit of that, but could you talk some more?
Yeah, as I mentioned, they really came out of the union movement. Sewer socialism is sometimes described as an electoralist approach, but there's no basis for that. If anything, it was first and foremost based in the union movement, and they led the unions from 1899 onwards, and they saw really the central goal of theirs to build a stronger working class. And so the way they measured their success wasn't the number of laws they passed, but it's whether the workers' movement was getting stronger. That's kind of how they gauged whether they were being successful. So for them, it was an absolutely central question of getting workers into unions, having those unions engage in politics. So this is a big thing that differentiated them from the AFL-CIO, or AFL, actually, of Sam Gompers, which had this mostly apolitical approach. And they proved it to be successful. They essentially was a joint union political project. Their newspaper, for instance, the Milwaukee Leader, socialist paper, was of the socialists and the unions. It was funded by the unions, if anything, even more. So it went hand in hand. They had this idea of like a two-branch movement, where you have the unions on one side and the political party on the other, but you're moving in the same direction.
That newspaper, I mean, the common joke about small party sects is that they all exist to sell the newspaper. But this newspaper was not quite like that, was it?
No, it was a mass newspaper. It was a daily. You know, they ran the daily for three decades. And it's really fun when you read it, because it has this fun mix of socialist politics, but then also just like some tabloidy stuff and cartoons. You know, it was like reading a normal newspaper. But for them, it was important because they were building a political common sense amongst ordinary working people. And so it foregrounded a lot of the immediate day-to-day struggles. They really did use it to build a class-conscious common sense, and it was also a tool for them to go out and talk to all people, in particular all working people, in the city. And one of their famous innovations was something what they called the Bundle Brigade, which is that in the about month and a half leading up to an election, they would deliver a free copy of their newspaper to every single person in the city. And this required a huge apparatus of volunteers, you know, literally thousands of people. You can imagine something analogous to the Zoran volunteer campaign. People would get up at 5:30 in the morning on a Sunday morning. You know, you'd have kids and moms and dads getting up to deliver these papers. And it was a big operation, because also in Milwaukee, people spoke either English or German or Polish. So you had to canvass every house ahead of time to know what language they spoke. And it was a big apparatus, and it was a big logistical endeavor. And they were proud of it. They were proud of their ability to get their ideas into the hands of every person in Milwaukee. And so they didn't expect just small numbers of people to come around and eventually buy their paper. They went out and talked to the people where they were at and gave them a tool to help understand the world.
And as Bob Fitch used to say, socialism must be social. They followed that maxim, right?
Yeah. When I read about it, it feels like another world. I found all these amazing quotes of, you know, there would be competitions, kind of a friendly competition between the different branches on who had the better choir, you know, like who sang best. Music was very important for them. So they do a lot of parades. They had a lot of picnics and parades. And in the parades, there's one description of a, you know, old socialist said, "I remember in these parades, anybody with a horn came, and most of them were pretty good. Some of them weren't so great, but it was beautiful to see everyone was playing their horn in the parade." You know, so they had this effervescence, and it had this community feel, which feels to me almost just like another world today, in which it's just so atomized and which we're mediated through screens. And, you know, for them, that it was this really deeply textured culture. It wasn't just politics. It was how you related to other people, and you were really part of a word that right now it sounds very cheap, but a deep community. But that was in a very real sense. People felt themselves to be part of a collective, and it was fun. And the reason they were able to recruit so many people wasn't just that they delivered, but that it gave meaning in life. It was, in some ways, it was like churches at their best. That's how I think about it. It both gave a meaning in life and a vision of the future, but also just sort of a real community in the meantime that you could rely on when times got tough.
Yeah, it's funny. The Christian right does that in the U.S., but our people don't really so much.
Yeah, so we should bring it back. They were good organizers. They understood the importance of this stuff.
And what were their achievements? Did they make the sewers better? But what else?
Yeah. By all accounts, they were really the most successful city government anywhere in the country. It's funny because before they got elected in 1910, there was all of this scaremongering that socialists get elected, capital's going to flee, the economy's going to collapse, city's going to be chaos. And you know, in the bourgeois media kept on making these predictions. But the exact opposite happened, so much so that by 1936, Time magazine felt obliged to write a cover piece on Daniel Hone in Milwaukee, who's the mayor. You know, the piece is called Marxist Mayor. It says he gave Marx all the credit. And in there, they say basically everybody acknowledges that Milwaukee is probably the best governed city in America. And so they really achieved quite a lot, to give just some of the highlights. First of all, they ended the widespread corruption that was endemic across the U.S. and in Milwaukee. And that was part of the reason they kept on getting elected, is that they were honest and they refused to get bribed. But they really did make real significant improvement in people's lives. It was a dramatic expansion of public services. They made housing more affordable. They built up the park system. They provided social services and sort of community centers, which didn't exist before. They made it much easier to unionize. This is, again, you know, one of the things we mentioned. They really went out of their way to stop companies from breaking strikes. They were able to neutralize essentially the city police. And this is an interesting thing. You always want to know, what do you do if you're socialist, and how do you deal with the police? Well, essentially what they did is they didn't try to defund the police, but they actually gave better wages to cops. They passed rules saying that basically cops couldn't intervene in strikes. And then they polarized the ranks of the police against the very reactionary police chief. So they kind of went over the head of the police chief and went over some of the police. And in that process, they were able to essentially neutralize that really agency of the state, which is so much, it became so important that Milwaukee ended up getting the highest union density percentage of workers in unions anywhere in the country. By the late 1930s, they had 60% union density, which is almost double what New York reached at its peak. You know, this is like Sweden levels of union power, nothing compared. And so, they succeeded in building a mass working class movement and making the city much more livable. And that's why they kept on getting elected for so long.
And they also bought food and clothing in bulk and sold it to the people below cost, which is an interesting thing. And it sure makes me think of Zoran's grocery stores, but on a bigger scale.
Yeah, I love that thing. I had no idea. And then I kind of picked that up doing the research. During World War One, remember, there's this huge scarcity of food. And so there's a lot of speculation. The price of goods were going up. And Mayor Hone went over to the city council, because this is another thing, just keep in mind, they did all of this despite not having a majority in the city council for most of the time. And so he just went over the head of the city council, used money to directly buy surplus food from the army, shipped it, train carloads and carloads of food and clothing, and sold it at price, for, you know, which was like half off, to Milwaukeeans. And it was a huge success. And it was extremely controversial, because they're saying, you know, you're subverting the free market, you're a communist, blah, blah, blah. But it worked, and people loved it, and you know, he was very proud of it. He says, you know, look, we're showing that the government can provide better than big business, and that was a good example.
And it ended after, what, 50, 60 years? How and why?
The short version is that the real defeat came in 1940. There was sort of like a last revival from 1948 to 1960, where they elected another socialist mayor, but it was different by then. The movement had really been defeated already, and there was a different dynamic. So if you really want to understand why it was defeated, you have to look at the late 1930s. And contrary to what the left oftentimes thinks, in which the number one obstacle to our side is people always getting co-opted and just getting absorbed into the system, that's not what happened. They stayed radical. They didn't get absorbed. But public opinion in Milwaukee and across the nation really started to turn against the left and the union movement in the late 1930s, really starting in 1938. There's a big backlash because there's sit-down strikes everywhere. There's a sense of the country's like on the verge of chaos. Roosevelt, the perception was he was going too far. The socialists were pushing him too far. And there was a real backlash. The working people, you know, their base stuck by with them. But if you just have at the margins some middle-class people, some a few workers flip, by 1940, they lost their majority in running for mayor because there was backlash against how sort of militant they were being and how radical. And that's it's kind of a sobering dynamic because it's sad to feel like sometimes we lose not because we sold out or had the wrong policies, but just because the other side was too strong. And that's what happens. Sometimes just the other side is too strong. And in a country like the U.S., where public opinion is relatively conservative, it's not as easy as we think to get as far as we want to go.
Finally, what lessons would you draw from this experience for Zora Rahn in New York City or Katie Wilson in Seattle?
I would point to one big dynamic, which maybe has gotten less explored so far in our discussion, which is that they understood that the way you could pass progressive and ambitious policies wasn't exclusively through just wheeling and dealing within the state. It wasn't just that you would elect them and they would get it done, but they understood that passing ambitious reforms required changing the relationship of class forces and a huge amount of mass organizing outside of the state. And so they were very conscious about doing this because they didn't have a majority in city council for most of this time period. The mayor didn't have that much control on their own. So they repeatedly and concertedly put pressure campaigns on other politicians, both in Milwaukee and then across the state, because they had a lot of the same preemption issues that we face in a place like New York. They had to build a real mass movement to essentially scare these establishment politicians into passing these policies because they wanted the socialists to be defeated, but they also didn't want to get elected out of office. So the socialists leaned on that contradiction. They built a mass movement, and they didn't stop politics after Election Day. If anything, they ramped it up. And I think in New York City, that's what we're going to have to see. You're going to have to make it clear to New Yorkers that the only way we're going to get these policies is if we fight for them. Zoran's not going to be able to do it on their own. It's the same in Seattle, and it's the same anywhere else where there's going to be a real leftist in power. It's going to be up to us outside to make it happen.
That was the labor journalist and scholar Eric Blanc. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this, some of Big-Eyed Beans from Venus by Captain Beefheart. Till next week, bye.
Distant cousins, there's a limited supply. And we're down to the dozens, and this is why. Big-Eyed Beans from Venus, oh my, oh my. Boys and girls, Earth people around the circle, fishes of man alive. Big-Eyed Beans from Venus, don't let anything get in between us. Beam in on me, baby, and we'll beam together. I know we've always been together, but there's more.